So this is the second day of our four-day retreat here in Tampa in January 2013, on deconstructing the world of self. There seemed to be a lot of questions. I really didn't look at them, but they all seemed, I looked at them last night when they came in, they all seemed to be important. So I think we'll deal with them. Let me just say a quick thing about personal interviews, the process. Maybe it wasn't clear. So when the period starts, whether it's in the morning or the evening, which would mean when I would get up to go into the interview room, or if your time is, let's say, between 3:30 and 4:30 in the afternoon, at that point, everybody who is assigned for that time will get into the chairs, and there should be hopefully enough chairs there for everybody. Then as the bell is rung, the first person goes, and everybody would move up a seat. I don't know if you've been doing that. That way, it'd be very clear that there is one seat available. And that way, seats will become available as we move through it. Now, again, because of the constraints of time, I don't know when I end whether there are still people waiting. So that's just a given. But otherwise, I will. That's the way it'll work, okay? So if you're sitting there and you see there's a chair available, you can go take it. So I wanted to clear that up. Yes?
I think the first person has been sitting, or the next person to come in has been sitting in the little reception area there in front of...
Yeah, that's a no-no. Right. Trying to get a little jump on things. So I can... I appreciate the ardor, but it would give a false sense of, yeah. Yes. And are there any other questions? So again, this is our second day, just from my doing the interviews with a number of people now. My sense is that people are getting it in various ways, but people are getting it, and it seems to be working. Again, as I said to you on the first day, which was yesterday, this is a wonderful practice because each of us have a very highly developed self that we are learning does permeate, suffuse, and dominate so much of our life. And when we all of a sudden begin to look at it that way and see the I, me, mine, and how it is functioning and how it is distorting things, it becomes very clear to people the powerful role that self and self-identity, the I, me, mine, plays in our life. The central role. It is the central thing around which our personal life and interpersonal life is predicated on. It's really the basis of everything for most of us. So it is important that we are doing what we're doing, which is not just reading about it, not just talking about it. And when I get into the skandhas, you'll understand more why, for those of you who have thought about it, read about it, kind of in a certain way meditated on it, why it still hasn't really made a big change. It's because it hasn't gotten in deeply enough. And not only has it not gotten in deeply enough through our capacity to study and really reflect on, we have not been able to name it. You know, what just came to me is, you know, people who live in the dualistic world of a lot of theology, for all the bad things in life, and that voice that whispers in one's ear, telling one to do bad things, right? That is called the voice of who? What? Satan, but in other kinds of theology, it's called the what? The devil. Yeah, it's called the devil or Satan, right? So it's clearly identified, right? That that voice that is telling you to do all those mischievous things and bad things, right, has a name. And the name is what? The devil. Satan. And it is... I mean, I just thought of that. And that at least gives people an opportunity to name it. I'm not going into the correctness of that or theology or that, but it's given a name, right? Yeah. And it just struck me that in Buddhism, which is very different, that voice is given a name. The name of self. And it is seen as the source of all that is bad in this world. It's interesting. Except as opposed to seeing it as, you know, something outside of us, it is seen as something that we are creating. So in that sense, it's very different. Because Buddhism is very different than other types of theologies. It's not a theology. So it doesn't see that as some force outside of ourselves that's trying to gain control of us. But I think it's interesting because, in a certain way, it's the self kind of acts like that. And it is important that we are able to name it. Not name it as bad or evil or anything like that, but name it for what it is, which is, it is something that is not, and we'll talk about today, to not, it is something that is not real. It is something that is not true. And it is something that is giving us advice that is skewed in such a distorted way that it makes it impossible for us to achieve that which we want to achieve, which is to be happy, peaceful, human beings capable of love and loving relationships and compassion, you know, all those good qualities. It cannot deliver on that in any meaningful way. So it is not only important that we study our mind, our behavior, our speech, our thoughts, to really see the pernicious, all-encompassing influence of this thing called self or I, me, mine, but that we can name it as something that is inherently not healthy for us, not good for us. It is not supportive of the kind of way we want to manifest in this world. And I think once we understand how it functions, and once we can understand its purpose, what its goals and agendas are, and we can clearly see that those are no longer congruent with ours, then it is possible to significantly move away from an ego or self-based way of living. But until we really do that in a significant way, so as we were saying earlier, there is real intention and there's real commitment to the intention, we will constantly be disappointed or frustrated at our kind of lack of progress. And our lack of progress is clearly arising because the energy, the habit energy of self-centered living and the addiction to the identification with self is so deep and has been reinforced, you know, for so long. It's just powerful. And unless we are really very conscious and clear and intentional about what's going on and really are clear to in charting a new path for ourselves, it is very difficult. Because we really think that it is us. It seems normal, right? It seems normal. It seems right. Our view of things seems right and just and true, right? Yes, we do. It is very seductive. And unless we, through a meditative stance, are able to develop some objectivity, some clarity around self, because as you're learning over this past day, it can be seen through the techniques of meditation and concentration, mindfulness, insight, learning to be the witness of one's behavior, to watch the mind. Watching the mind. Who talks about watching the mind than crazy people like us? Right? I mean, when people get together, is that what they're talking about? Have you been observing your mind lately, and what have you noticed? I mean, people would look at you like, what's happened to Beth? Oh yeah, I've been spending a lot of time watching my mind lately. It's really quite fascinating. Let's gossip about other people. That's more fun. Right. You know, I had a thought about Gasparilla. I was up in my room and I heard a lot of hooting and hollering. And I thought, oh, Gasparilla. And, you know, and again, sociologists, anthropologists can say a lot more profound things than I could possibly say. But it struck me, you know, these type of displays, we could call them, of human activity are really very known in many cultures, right? These kinds of, I've never been to Gasparilla, but I mean, I would think this kind of dressing up and, you know, acting out and kind of bacchanalia and drunkenness and revelry and, Mardi Gras and all kinds, these are very much part of human societies. And again, you know, I'm just seeing it from the lens of what we're doing here. I think in a certain way, on the one hand, while human beings are totally in the throes of self, which manifests as identities and roles and responsibilities and needs and wants and objectives, the whole thing. On the other hand, that way of life is ultimately very constricting, very narrow, and it produces a lot of doesn't produce a lot of happiness and well-being and ease in life. So I think in most people, there's a constraint in being themselves, and there's a constraint in their roles and activities in life and the whole thing in all kinds of societies. And it's just, I think, psychologically very freeing to at least for a day or 2 days or 3 days, just get out of it, right? Get out of the role, get out of the identity, you know, become somebody else. Right? I think in a certain way, there's a kind of release that for someone like me, it looks so strange that one would even want to do that. But then I was trying to understand, well, why would somebody want to do it? And then I understood, well, of course, you know, it feels free to dress up and become a pirate and talk like a pirate and be bawdy, and, you know what I mean, and romp around and rape and pillage and, you know. Because again, I don't know who the Gasparilla people are, but my understanding, they are the right at the core of it, Doug would know, right? I mean, they're the muckamucks of Tampa, the people who wear the suits and the tie, right? So their life is very constrained, right? Very restricted. They're very proper. You know what I mean? And then
some of them.
Some of them. And then all of a sudden they can just, right? And then just all of a sudden they can just be pirates. Be a kid again. Be a pirate. Be free. Have fun. You know? And if you can see, in a certain way, those are good things. You know what I mean? I mean, those are very human things. And yet it's... Anyhow. So let us look at some of these questions. Oh, there was just and again, I'm not here for the guided meditations, and I don't know who wrote this, but somebody just says, Sometimes the guided meditations are just given at length and without pause, and there was no time to really establish oneself in meditation and perform the prescribed investigations to any real depth. So that's just a comment on one person on the guided meditations. So I just say that for the sake of the people doing the guided meditations. Fred, is the voice thought that says there's the self which is not present awareness part of the self egoic mind? If not, what is it? See, these are things which I will not answer. Because these are the things that in the investigating mind is, we want to ask ourselves, what is that voice, right? There seems to be this, on the one hand, right, there is this incredible emotion-driven, nutsy, endless drama of self, right? And then somebody's saying, but then there's another voice that goes, oh, that's just a drama of self. And I can be aware of that. What is that voice? Next time you hear that voice, please turn your awareness, your attention to that voice. What is that voice? What is that voice? But it's a good voice, isn't it? Better than the other voice. I think later on there is a question about which voice do you listen to. But in the world of self, as I said yesterday, on the one hand there is this deluded self that just goes around totally ensnared with itself, totally living from its false needs and wants and endless demands for more, constantly dissatisfied. And then there is another voice, right, that wants to end that, that sees that it is a painful way of living, and that seems to be encouraging us to move in another direction, right? So in the world of selves, there seem to be different kinds of manifestations, don't there? Yeah. As I said yesterday, in the creation of self, there is a self that is totally conditioned by externality that then the individual mind is responding to, reacting to. And therefore this false self gets created, which then again, as we talked about yesterday, through constant identification and playing out and different situations over years, more and more do we get wedded to at a certain point, we're not even in reality anymore. We are in the drama. And there are many people, you know, again, I'm just a sick guy. But I think it's fascinating. If you've ever gone to like any place where, like a tourist or something, and you see people get off the bus with their cameras, go over to the whatever it is they've come to see, and just take pictures of each other in front of the thing, and then go back on the bus. Have you noticed that? And it struck me because they're like seeing the experience like when they're telling people about it. They're in this. They see their life like it's a story that they're going to tell somebody else about. And here's Fred, you know, at the tour, at the Eiffel Tower. But Fred really never had an experience at the Eiffel Tower. He's got a picture to show them. right? Did you know, it's crazy. And this is, and now with everybody, you know, everybody has a camera now. And you can take a picture of yourself everywhere and immediately, what's it called? You can
Facebook
it, or you can email it, or you can, so, you know, it's like we see our experience through somebody else's eyes. I mean, there's no time for us to have an experience. We're already communicating it like a story. That is the world of self. It sees yourself, your personhood, as an object to be manipulated to make a story for others to read, because you're always concerned about how others see you, right? Because whenever we take the picture, what do we immediately do? You ever see it? I mean, I forget where we were. It's like, as soon as the camera is pointing your way, what do people do?
Smile.
Having a great time. As soon as the camera's away, they go back to their normal face. Right? I mean, we all do it, but it's like we have to give this message that what? Everything's wonderful and I'm happy. Right? Doesn't matter where I am. Right? You get home and you show them 5,000 pictures. And you look the same in every one of them. Right? You know, but how really was the trip? Do you know, what did you experience? I can't believe it. From the moment you got off the plane, you just smiled the whole time. Again, I have nothing against smiling. I have nothing against pictures, but it's interesting. And I think, again, and I'm not somebody obviously involved in all this electronic stuff, but I think with the immediacy of people, I mean, I sometimes with my children and my nieces and nephews and whatever, you know, I like ask them, you know, because they're always, you know, like getting messages, you know, like, whatever, you know, I'm fascinated by it. You know, it's like so important because they're always checking it, you know. So I thought there must be something important going on. You know, and it's just the minutiae of someone's day. You know, just had breakfast. And they're emailing that to people. The toast was a little burnt. You know, like, talk to you later. I really thought they were kind of sharing at deep level. But it was just, you know, it's, you know, constant story. And now we send pictures. I mean, it's again, it's almost like we have left experience, left our lives, and are living in this, you know, mental place outside of our life where we see ourselves through other people's eyes. Can't wait, you know. You know, it's also another experience, and this is all about self. That's why I'm belaboring here. It's like, you know, my experience by itself is not valid until I tell somebody else about it. Right? I mean, that's fascinating. For me to experience it, it's not valid. It's not meaningful, right? You know, I got to call up Beth and tell her right away what just happened, right? Now we're talking about it, and Beth is going, "Wow, that's really something." And now I feel like I had a valid experience, because somebody else has validated it. But just by myself, that wasn't enough. I mean, that's what I think is sort of a lot of this iMessaging or whatever it is. It's like I want somebody else to see what I'm doing, because it doesn't have any meaning just here for me. Does that make sense? My life is a story. We are scripting our lives, how we want other people to see it. Here I am having a great time. Life is wonderful. You know, and you send it out to what? Hundreds of people. Through language, we turn our life into a story. We turn our life into a drama. And it's a drama. The sad thing is, it's not only a drama for the consumption of others, but it also becomes a drama for our own consumption. Right? Because I tell the story to myself. Good job, Fred. Right? We talk to ourselves. Gee, that was really terrible. I can't believe so and so said that to me. So I mean, we run our own drama for ourselves and turn it into a story. Right. By the way, there really is no such thing as a self. There's no such thing as an egoic mind at all. And everything, anything that is that manifests in thought as a thought is a fabrication. What is the most effective practice to address the existential feeling of being separate? You know, it is a process. Again, we have to ask the question. Remember I said earlier, it's learning to ask the right question is central to a meaningful spiritual life. So, what is the most effective practice to address the existential feeling of being separate? The question that I would ask myself if I was this person said, where does this feeling of separation come from? Why is it do I feel separate? Because when I understand, if you think about the Four Noble Truths, right? It is the model for us, right? There's something, there has to be a cause. Understand the cause, you're free of it. Right? First Noble Truth, dukkha, suffering, dissatisfaction. Second Noble Truth, there's a cause, there's a reason. Why it exists, why it comes into being. Third, there is, you know, the possibility of it ceasing is inherent in the fact that there's a cause. If something is caused, if it's not being caused, then it doesn't manifest. So therefore, one is free of it. Is that clear? If there are causes of suffering, when those causes are eliminated, there is no suffering. That which is called the state of when there is no suffering is called nirvana. It is logical. So, if someone is feeling separation, disconnection, one hears words like interbeing. One hear words like interdependence. One hear words like oneness. Somebody was talking about union. I mean, these kinds of words. And, you know, that this is the that this is the way things are. Everything is interconnected, which means that we are interconnected. Right? Nothing is truly separate, which means that our true state is where there is no separation from anyone or anything. So if that is the true state, we have to ask ourselves, why then do I feel separate? Why do I feel alone? Stuck in this separateness. Why don't I feel connected to people, to nature, to life, whatever these things are, to the cosmos? We have to ask ourselves. And Buddhism says what? It's because we have developed in our mind this identification as ourself as separate. It is a fabrication of the mind. If you eliminate that fabrication, you eliminate that separation. It is something that you can experience. Because it is the way things are. You don't have to manufacture it. You don't have to do anything. We are doers, and we think we got to do something. No, we got to stop doing something. Stop fabricating all the things that we fabricate that creates the sense of separation. When I see Marilyn, and there's no Fred here, right? There's just Marilyn. Right? And if I am 100% present aware, right? It is our awareness undefiled by any type of fabrication or any sense of a posited I or separation or you. See, if I see Marilyn as Marilyn, with a name, with a label, and I have all my projections and thoughts about who Marilyn is and what she, and where she is and what she did and who she's married to, and what, you know, and she's a woman, you know what I mean, her issue, you know. I am no longer connected to this. I'm connected to what? My thoughts about this. I am not connecting with her, I'm connecting to my thoughts about her. And we think we're connecting, we're not connecting. It's when I let go of all that stuff that is separating. Somebody talked about, oh, I'm seeing myself as a filter. Well, that's not bad. It's a filter, which means what? What does a filter do?
Yeah,
it doesn't let everything through, does it? Yeah. And there are all kinds of filters. There are gross filters, there are very subtle, fine filters. You know, I mean, there are all kinds of filters. Yeah. But the bottom line is, a filter is not letting everything, therefore it is distorting. All our fabrications are distorting what is happening in life. And therefore we do not connect. Because how can we connect? Because we're up here. Remember? We're up here. The Eiffel Tower is an object to send a picture of me in front of to somebody else. I've never connected with the Eiffel Tower. How do you connect with the Eiffel Tower? Look at a picture of it? How do you connect with the Eiffel Tower? Anybody ever been to the Eiffel Tower? How do you connect with the Eiffel Tower? Yeah, you walk it. But if you walk it and you're thinking about what you're going to have for dinner or what happened yesterday, you're still not connecting, even though you're there. But when you're at the Eiffel Tower and you are walking it and you are feeling it and you are touching it and you are, you know what I'm saying? And when you are looking at the views and the people and you're connected to the whole, you could say, yeah, I was at the Eiffel Tower. Right? And if there was somebody else who had the same experience, I'd say, oh, yeah, I understand. But nowadays, people go, oh, they'll take out the picture. You mean this one? Yeah, here I am. and you take out your picture, and here I am. And you're both smiling. Right. But that's not a connection. So this is very important to understand. This is a fundamental difference with the Buddhist view. From the time of the great enlightenment of the Buddha until today, our inherent undefiled nature of pure awareness, to give it a name, is here. You don't have to do anything to experience it. It is right here. We just have to stop doing that. You know, we have to take away the filter. And then, right? And then things will flow. The water wants to flow, right? Just pull out the filter. Clean the window so you can see clearly. It's already here. We already are connected to everything because we are part of everything. Right? It's only because we've kind of pulled ourselves out of nature, out of reality, and see ourselves as a separate, distinct entity called the self, called the me, that we have lost our connection. You know, if you read Thich Nhat Hanh lately, he's somewhat pessimistic about, I mean, in his writings lately, he sort of seems to be saying, yeah, it looks like this whole global warming thing and this whole thing is going to happen, and major kind of cataclysmic things are just going to unfold in human history. And he says, human beings can't even stop their own individual suffering. They don't have a clue about how could they possibly get it together to stop the suffering they're inflicting on the earth. Right? I mean, it's very interesting what he says. He says, human beings, you know, they can't, just as individuals, they're so dominated by their own self-interest and greed and, you know, and all this and short-term happiness, you know what I mean, short-term, meeting their short-term needs. You know, just as individuals, I mean, you think they're capable of really addressing the suffering of the earth? It doesn't mean there aren't individuals, but he's talking about the global humanity. It's a tough sell. So again, what are the most effective practices to address the existential feeling of being separate? All those practices which allow us to leave the world of self, to leave the world of conceptualization and endless fabrication and drama, all the practices of mindfulness, concentration, and insight into the real nature of self, the real nature of mind, these practices are about ending the separation. So one experiences the natural sense of connection, which is here. You don't have to do anything. Has anybody here ever felt connected to another human being or an animal? Okay. And if you can think of this human being, child, adult, infant, dog, cat, bird. If you can think of that person that you really felt connected to, was it a lot of work to connect with them? A lot of work? You have to really work at it? No. I would suggest to you it was one of the easiest things you've ever done. It just happened. Well, how could it have just happened? Because that is our natural state. We didn't have to do anything. But because we are sick individuals, we don't realize that that kind of openness and caring and feeling that they are, you know, their happiness is my happiness, their suffering is my suffering. There is no difference, right? is what enlightenment's about. It's knowing that in all situations for everyone. It just, you know, we just open things a crack for certain individuals or certain experiences. You know, such as there are some people when they, you know, go deep into nature, they feel a deep connection, right? That they don't feel in their daily life. They don't feel with humankind. But all of a sudden, when they get into a very natural setting and enough time's elapsed, all of a sudden they can feel something different. Right? A sense of deep connection and peace, oneness, all these words. Right? And it doesn't happen because you're doing something. Saying everything is interconnected is not an experience. In Buddhism, we want the experience, not the words. That's why in Zen, if you say things like everything is one, or the teacher says, go wash your mouth out with soap. Right? You've just defiled pure experience with words, which in no way can express the truth. Right. What does the word flower have to do with this? Nothing. All the word flower does, at least points in a direction. But if you don't see this for what it is, you don't know it. It doesn't know it's a flower. Did you know that? It doesn't know it's a flower. It doesn't call itself a flower. It just is this. Why is that not enough for us? Why do we have to say, it's a flower, it's a sunflower, it's a beautiful flower? Does that add anything to this? Make the experience of this richer? We think it does. Quick, get out the iPhone, take a picture. Sam, Sam's going, he's taking a picture. Gotta send it to somebody. Here, looking at a flower. Thinking of you. The flower's going, I thought you were just thinking of me. Why is this not enough? If we strive for no self to be real, why do we practice loving kindness and the other immeasurables, and why do we strive to be a bodhisattva? So we sort of covered that. These are words, loving kindness, compassion. Um, with your loved one, the person, the animal that you feel so deeply connected. Connected, see, it's a word. It means that somehow when you're with them, there's no separation. You don't feel a boundary between yourself and them. It's like it's all just, you know, again, I don't want to use words. You know what I'm saying? Do you have to work at being kind? Huh? Do you really have to work at, you know, really, if you see them suffering, going, I got to remember that I'm supposed to do something about their suffering because I'm a compassionate person. Is that the way it works?
No.
No. It's natural. It's spontaneous. So we please understand that in our true state, in our natural state, in the natural state of our mind, loving kindness and compassion are natural components of it. Right? You've heard me say before, you know, when your elbow hurts, your right hand will reach out and massage it. Right? Jun came in to interview today, right? Her nose was bleeding, and her hands were very kindly holding a tissue to her nose, right? The hands weren't going, why do I got to do this? I'm not bleeding, right? What's this have to do with me? Right? Let the nose take care of itself. It wasn't like that, was it? The hand just naturally was willing to hold the tissue. Because the hand and the arm and the nose are connected. There's an unconscious connection where it just naturally and spontaneously the hand takes care of the nose, because the hand doesn't see itself as a hand, and the nose doesn't see itself as a nose. It's part of one body. So it's all very natural and spontaneous. But because we have drifted so far away into separation, disconnection, egocentricity, it is for that reason that we have to do practices like the Four Immeasurables. This character's got to do those practices. Because all it thinks about is who? Itself. Right? So we got to very consciously talk to this guy and go, now you're connected to this body, and if you just kind of follow it into the central nervous system, you will see that there's also a connection that goes out here, and that this hand is part of your body. So, you know, at some point, you may be hurting, and you might like that hand to reach over and massage you. So therefore, it only is kind of logical and in your own self-interest that you reach over and massage that hand. So if the time ever arises, right? See, we have to explain it. Why? Because this hand somehow has gotten the notion that it's a separate hand, right? And exists unto itself, and all it cares about is how it's doing. Right? I'm doing fine. Look at this. What do I care about the rest of that body? Life is good for me. We laugh, but that is the life of the ego, of the self. So because of that, Buddhas and teachers for thousands of years just invent one practice after another. Right? The books keep going out there's a new 5 new books this week. To what? To get the hand to see that it's connected to the whole body. And it is the body. The hand has no separate existence. heart's going to be very, the head, the hand's going to be very disappointed when the heart gives out and it realizes it's over. The hand might be going, gee, if I had known that, I probably would have been kinder to the heart over those years. Right? I didn't know that. I was connected to that. Right? I didn't know that I was connected to the earth. Gee, if I thought I was connected to the earth, I wouldn't have been, you know, so blind to all the harm I was doing it all these years. I wouldn't have known. So it's because of that, because of the state we're in, that practices such as the Four Immeasurables, loving kindness, exchanging self and others, are developed to kind of get us out of this and begin to move us in the direction of truth, that we are all one, and that my pain is your pain. And your happiness is my happiness. But until it becomes a realization, we have to practice the Four Immeasurables. Right? Is that clear? How does one know when they are listening to the wise and healthy essence of being and not the artificial self? That's a good question. So I think that sort of ties in with that some earlier question about, you know, voices. Voices in the head. We might say, call them, right? Lots of voices? Lots of voices, right? I mean, Ned told us yesterday that he's been listening to a voice for 50 years that constantly gives him bad advice, and yet he still listens to it, right? Ned might say, but I've been reading all this self-help stuff, and it's all saying, trust yourself, right? Isn't everybody ever heard that? Trust yourself. Learn to trust your inner voice, right? You've heard that one. But Ned goes, gee, when I listen to that inner voice, is that the one I'm supposed to trust? Right? Yeah. And I think that is true. We need to start where we are. And for many of us, where we are is we do not hear a consistently wise voice that we can clearly identify that is active 24/7 inside ourselves. We hear many voices, and we hear voices that are pretending to be wise and say, listen to me, and we don't know. Where is the chanting sheet? Can you read the three refuges? The refuge. Yeah. Or maybe, and can you give it to me? I should probably read it. I'm just thinking. Alex, you missed your cue. You're supposed to be telling. You used to be so on top of me. What's happened?
I'm not a self anymore. We're connected.
Always Woody Allen.
The fully enlightened one, beautifully seated, peaceful smiling, a living source of understanding and compassion, to the Buddha I go to refuge. Buddha, living source of understanding and compassion. The path of mindful living, the Dharma, healing, joy, enlightenment, way of peace, I go to refuge. The loving, supportive community of practice, realizing harmony, awareness, liberation, to the Sangha I go to refuge. Traditionally in Buddhism, we begin by taking refuge. We take refuge just for that reason that this person is asking. That at this point, when we are beginning our practice, we don't have a consistently wise, intelligent, enlightened voice inside us. Oftentimes, we hear many competing voices. We have all kinds of things going on inside us. And many people still go, gee, I still hear my mother's voice, or my father's voice, or my... That's why, you know, we think we're hearing our voice, but we don't have a clue. There's so many voices inside us. Right? Voice of ego, the voice of self, the need, the voice of need, of want, all these core beliefs we have about our inferiority and our no goodness and our unlovability. I mean, you know, those are all voices too, right? So many voices. You know. Okay. So the question is, all right, I want a different life, but I cannot really find a voice inside me that is consistently reliable and trustworthy and wise yet. So what do I need to do? I need to find something external that I can trust, rely on, etc., to guide me so I can, in time, develop that. I mean, that's the goal. The goal is to become a Buddha. A Buddha is a fully enlightened one, which means one is in touch with one's own true nature, one's own natural spontaneous wisdom, and you know what I mean? And that's what's guiding us. Right? It's all now here. But we're not there yet, right? So we need external support. We need guidance. We need teachers. We need mentors. We need teachings that seem logical and practical that we can follow. So in the beginning, that's the voice, right? Over time, you may begin to experience that voice, those teachings, those teachers, those readings that were so external to you are now becoming, you begin to hear them inside you. Right? You begin to hear them inside you. So when you're starting to go here, the voice goes, don't do that. That's only going to cause you suffering. That's not nice. You don't want to cause pain to others. You want to support them. You know what I mean? So you begin, oh, and that should feel, that means it's getting in. It's not just here. It's not just another, you know, your spiritual voice is just not another competing voice among the other 25. It's like it speaks with a certain kind of authenticity. You know what I mean? Like, and you know it. So it is a process. And there is nothing wrong. I mean, a lot of... some people have a problem with things like taking refuge. And that, to me, is just a problem of ego. Self. I'm too good to need somebody else to guide me. Really? And how come you're not enlightened already? How come you keep creating suffering for yourself and others? So I think it is the only intelligent thing to do, When one is lost, one needs a guide to help one get out. To pretend you're not lost is denial. Right? And to think that you know the way out when you don't is what? What?
Ignorance.
Ignorance. Delusional. Stupid. Foolish. Speaking for myself, if I'm lost, the first person that comes along that says they know the way out, I say, take me. Right? Right? You know the way out? I'm following you. No, I mean, I'm not an idiot. So if somebody comes along and says, oh, I know the way out, I would might ask him a question or two, right? Have you done it before? You know, have you found the way out yourself? Have you been out? You know, if they kind of begin to hem and haw, well, I think I know how to get out of here. I mean, you know, or I met somebody once and they told me that it's kind of, well, again, it depends how desperate I am. You know, if that's the only person, I may have no choice. But if I know there are other choices, I may look for somebody who what? Who says, yeah, I used to be lost, and I've been out, and I've been out 100 times. Yeah, it's very clear, it's very simple. Yeah, come on, let's go. Right? So it just makes sense to admit I'm lost. A lot of competing voices, a lot of self, a lot of nonsense still driving me around, right? And, you know, I really, so again, you might go, but aren't you supposed to, you know, trust yourself? And I would say, yes. Making a wise decision to find somebody to help you, that's smart. That's a good decision. Shows you're waking up. You're acknowledging, I can't tell which of my voices is the authentic one. I'm not in touch. I've been living so long with so many different voices inside me telling me, go this way, you'll be happy. Go that way, you'll be happy. Do this, you'll feel fulfilled. Do that, you'll feel fulfilled. You know, I can't hear one consistent, authentic voice that I really know. So maybe I'll just stop listening for a while to all the voices and follow somebody else's voice. One clear, intelligent, wise, compassionate, understanding voice that knows me and can tell me how to get where I want to go. Right? I mean, does that sound crazy? Or does that sound sane? Alex goes to China, doesn't speak a word of Chinese. He's got an address he wants to get to. He's in Beijing. Right? I mean, Alex could, you know, he's got the address here. Right? He could just on his own go looking for that house. Right? I'm going to find it. He may, by the time he's almost dead, find it. Right? I mean, or maybe sooner. He could find it, couldn't he? But he could also find somebody who knows their way around Beijing, who can say, oh, yeah, I know where it is, and, you know, I can take you there. I mean, wouldn't that make it easier? Now, again, somebody could go, but look at all the, you know, look at all the adventures Alex has had. Well, if your purpose in life is to have endless adventures, you're absolutely right. But if you, if there is some place you want to get to, right, then that's a different criteria. You know, so it's a very personal, there's no right or wrong, is there? It's just, it's really a very personal, you know, have I had enough of this kind of thing? Am I done? Am I ready to move on to something else? It's a very personal, you know, it's a very personal. And it's something that we have to answer, because that will predicate what our next steps are. Self-interest. Daily I receive requests for donations in the mail. I discriminate based on preference. And if I receive tax receipts, usually giving more to those organizations where I receive a tax receipt, i.e. self-interest, yes, it is wrong to make these kinds of decisions. I don't know. In this world, we make choices. And we each have to be comfortable with the choices we make. And there is nothing wrong with taking care of oneself, making sure one eats right, so one has a healthy body and gets enough exercise, activity, has enough food, right, etc. Clothes, shelter, right? I mean, we have needs as human beings, and it is our job to take care of ourselves. We do our best to take care of ourselves financially. You know, at what point does our self-interest and our focus on taking care of me or preclude other types of possibilities? That's a question I think we should reflect on. How much of my decision making is based on total self-interest? I mean, I think that's an interesting question this person asked. I think money is, you know, one of the biggest egoic things in our society. There's a lot of self in our society, in money. And there's a lot of fear that people have. And again, it's because it's the messages that we're constantly receiving around money. And there's a lot of grasping and greed and around money and things. You know, I spent years living associated with, several years with Tibetans, the refugees. It was a very interesting society because, there weren't like people, you know, like everybody was the same. I mean, some had more and some had less. But it was very interesting to me that it seemed to be fairly common that what people did with their surplus wealth was give to the Dharma. I mean, that was like the societal thing. You know, like when you had enough for yourself, take care of your family, your yaks, your children, you know what I mean, and you took care of your house, make sure you had the new roof and all that when you kind of took care of your stuff, if you had more, you did all kinds of, you know, religious, spiritual things. You offered money to the monastery. You supported monks. You gave money to people so they could go on retreats. You know, those were the kind of things. Or you yourself went on pilgrimage and met teachers. And I mean, right? It was just interesting to me because we live in a culture where, you know, if you have surplus wealth, what do? You stockpile it, or you look around to see, or you stockpile it, or you look around and you think, what more can I get? You know, what more do I need? Right. Well, I have some surplus wealth. Time to get a new car, a new kitchen, a new right. I mean, that's the way we think, and that's considered normal. Right. To always think about money. It's for me. For me. It's my money. And I can do whatever I want with it, right? A lot of ego, self, as opposed to seeing money as just something that, you know, comes and moves around, and that it's an opportunity, like everything else in our life, to do what? To do good. To do good, that's what it's for, you know? Right? We say as bodhisattvas, you know, the purpose of my life is what? To awaken myself and bring benefit to others, right? That's what life's about, right? To free myself from all ignorance and all delusion and all self-centeredness. To cultivate all the positive attributes of what it really means to a human being, and to help other people and benefit other people. Right? So that's what these hands are about, that's what these eyes are about, that's what these minds, all the talents I have, I want to use them to benefit others, right? But don't you tell me what to do with my money. That's for me. Yeah. So, it's interesting. Are opinions and preferences acceptable if one doesn't get attached? In other words, is the goal to stop having them or just to realize they are meaningless because they are ego-based and therefore delusional and then let them go? What does it say in the... just to quote the... The great way is not difficult. For those who do not pick and choose, when preferences are cast aside, the way stands clear and undisguised. But even slight distinctions made set earth and heaven far apart. If you would clearly see the truth, discard opinions pro and con. To flounder in dislike and like is nothing but the mind's disease. Somebody wants to bargain. Can I keep my preferences and all my likes and dislikes if I'm not too attached to them? You know, one of the wonderful things about retreat as a practice experience is we have to give up control. I mean, that's why I think, there's lots of benefits to retreat, but one thing just at that level is there's a schedule, right? And that we have to comply to it, right? Whether we feel like it or not, whether we want to or not, right? Like you may be sitting there and you may be uncomfortable in your body or you may not like where your mind is, right? And you'd like to what? If you had your own preference, you'd like to what? Go take a walk, get out of here, right? But because of the schedule, right, and because of the commitment, we can't do that, can we? Which forces us to what? To either sit there and suffer because of our own self-created nonsense, or else to liberate ourselves, to see that it's just voices in our head that are saying, this is good, this is bad, I like this, I don't like that. I don't want to feel like this, or, you know, all that stuff, right? So that's why it's wonderful. Same way, you know, everybody may not want to get up at 6 o'clock, right? If they had their preferences, right? A big nod over there. And yet, you have no choice. And even though that may cause you discomfort, it's good. Because you see how, again, how we're trying to always control our world. And we are only mostly happy when we have it all under control. Then we're happy. You know? How are things? Things are good. Everything's under control. People talk that way. Everything's under control. Right? You know, when you talk to that person a month from now, if things aren't under control, how are they going to be? Unhappy. Things aren't good. Things are happening that I can't control. This person is doing this, and this happened there, and this person got sick. So, to come to retreat is to give up control. I mean, someone's cooking our food, right? We have all our preferences, this and that, the kind of foods we like and how we like and this and that. I can't do it, right? Many of us would like to, you know, I mean, what an imposition that we have to wait at the table for other people. Can you believe it? And they're just dawdling around up there, you know, God knows what they're doing. Right? Probably checking everything out and going so slowly. I mean, can't believe it. I got my plate in front of me and I want to eat it now. Right? What is that? That self, its preferences and its likes, only cares about what? Me and my plate of food. And getting that plate of food off the plate into my stomach. I mean, that's the kind of thing that self is concerned about. Right? And it makes a big deal about it. So, I mean, just part of who we are and kind of how we're conditioned. We have, likes and dislikes, preferences. Obviously, the less they are in number, the less they are in intensity, the more adaptable we are. Right? Take the cockroach. I don't know. I don't think cockroaches have preferences. They'll just kind of survive no matter where they are. Right? I mean, they'll do anything, you know? They're very adaptable. You know, things in nature that are adaptable are the ones that survive. It is your likes and dislikes, your preferences, that make you very unadaptable. The self is not adaptable because it's made up of our likes and dislikes and our preferences and our choices and all our stuff. And therefore, to be deep into self is to be deep into being a controlling, manipulative person. And everyone in here is like that, to one degree or another, aren't we? And it's all in the service of this self that wants things to be a certain way. And what better way to make things go my way so I can be happy, we don't even know what the I is, we'll be getting there, than to what? Than to be incredibly diligent in trying to control and manipulate every situation, every person in my life, right? So this self can be happy. Right, Robbie? Doesn't even let people close a screen door without wanting to do something. I'm gonna get over there and show that person how to close a screen door, so they can do it the way I want them to. And then I'll be happy. Because I'm doing walking meditation. When I'm doing walking meditation, I don't want to hear screen door slamming, do I? I want to control everything and everybody. And make it all go my way. And then I'll be what?
Happy.
Happy. But to get to that moment of happiness where everything's under control is miserable, is stressful. And our happiness only lasts a brief time. Because things are impermanent. And we really can't control anything. So it's always falling apart. And those of us who are, dedicated to control and manipulation will continue to what? To work diligently to get it all back under control. And we wonder why we're not happy. We wonder why we have stress and irritation and frustration and we feel separated and disconnected. Well, look at the strategy that self is giving us to be happy. It's a strategy that only has one result. Unhappiness and dissatisfaction. The Buddhist strategy is totally different. Let go. Accept. Be present. Be empty. Give up your preferences. Give up your likes and dislikes as much as you can. Be at ease. Be understanding. Be compassionate. Very different strategy. And last but not least, and then we'll have to end. At times during meditation, when looking back to see who is looking, I begin to experience that there is no one looking, that there is no looking, that there is no inside or outside. Other times throughout the day, while resting in awareness, I begin to taste the mirror-like nature of mind. Yet I can tell that these glimpses of non-self are still very superficial and drenched in self. How can I go further and plunge into the non-self essence completely? Well, that is another retreat. Actually, the Southern Dharma retreat this year is on the nature of mind and these practices of mind. But let me say to this person, so this person is looking deeply. Into that experience that we have, that there's somebody here. There is somebody who is talking, there is somebody who is thinking, there is somebody who is listening, there's somebody who's tasting, feeling, right? That there, behind it all, there's a somebody. And most people would say, that's me, that's Fred, that's myself. In Buddhism, and again, obviously tomorrow will be more of the day when I really get into it, that is not what Buddhism says. But even that's just theoretical. The truth is, there is that almost like a felt sense that we have that there is somebody who is doing all this, somebody who is talking. Somebody who's listening. I might be saying, well, I'm talking, and you may be saying, whoa, I am listening. Right? Two eyes. One eye is talking, the other eye is listening. Two selves communicating. And yet, because we are in a meditative tradition where we go beyond words and labels and appearances, right? We would say it appears that way, right? It appears that Fred is talking and Marilyn is listening. I can see her nodding, so, and her eyes are open. So, I mean, she could be, but she it appears that Marilyn is looking and listening and Fred is looking and talking. Would everybody agree in the world of conventionality, it appears to be that way? And yet, in meditative practice, we learn to turn our mind, or our attention, we could say, to that part of our mind where this self seems to, where we think this self is. That is, in this case, talking, or in Marilyn's case, there seems to be somebody listening. And so this person is saying, when they turn their awareness in that direction, where there appears or feels like, or there's a sensation that there is something, or that seems to be where the I thought is coming from, there's nothing there. That there's no one looking. And that actually looking is a word for this that we're all doing. Just a word. In meditative practice, we want to go deeper than the words into the experience. So this person says, when I go into the experience, there's just this. And this doesn't seem to have any inside or outside or any boundaries or definition. So this person is saying, so I think I'm getting a glimpse of what this non-self way of being. Non-self meaning that my experience is not mediated by a sense of a separate self, but it's still very superficial and drenched in self. How does one's deepening spiritual experience get drenched in self? Because sense self immediately comes in and goes, whew, I'm having quite an insight here. Things are really getting interesting. I'm advancing. My practice is coming together. I better instant message somebody and tell them. Quick posting to Facebook. I'm getting it. And of course, at that moment, whatever was a real experience is now totally lost. Not totally, that's extreme. Is lost. And it gets contaminated by self and conceptualization. So it's a good question. How can I go further and plunge into this non-self essence? Completely. That's what it's about. Good. So it is 12:10. Again, the reason I spent this time just answering the questions, because I felt the questions were coming out of the talk and the meditation and people's experiences. And as I said to you from the beginning, I want this retreat not just to be it's kind of a traditional retreat where kind of the teacher is teaching and you're listening and then you're meditating, and I want this to be much more interactive, kind of a process where we grow together to make sure that we're really getting it. So that's why I took the time today to answer these questions, and hopefully we are getting it. So, again, there will be guided meditations today. Sure, we go slowly and give people time to actually take it in and work it. again, you know, some people make a distinction, as I said earlier, between mindfulness and concentration and these kind of insight practices, some of which have a kind of analytical basis to them, where we're kind of reflecting and thinking about them, and some are just kind of a looking, a deep looking at something. But please understand that in insight, in deep looking, there has to be mindfulness and concentration for it to be successful. So again, what I suggest, as I said earlier, is that in your meditations, you always begin with your mindfulness of the breath and your concentration to quiet and still and stabilize the mind. Then you begin whatever you want, aspect of self that you want to investigate, you want to look at, you want to understand. Right? And do that as long as that inquiry is effective. And then stop and come back to your breath. Come back to just your mindfulness practice. Renew yourself. Right? And then, when you're ready, begin again. And many people are working on different people. A lot of people are just cataloging the endless manifestations of self and ego and I, me, mine in their life. Some people are really, like I think probably some of the meditations, really seeing how, bell versus my bell. And just adding the word my, how that changes the relationship just by adding that word, right? I tell Beth, that's an ugly shawl, and Angie just doesn't respond at all. I say to Angie, gee, that's an ugly sweater you're wearing. And all of a sudden, Angie starts having a little reaction. Now, what's the difference? When it was directed at Beth, calm, relaxed, no big deal. When it's directed at me, emotionality, drama. Okay. So we want to really see this, how adding the words I, me, mine really begin the process of drama and emotionality. Marilyn says, I just got word that my house burned down. Well, I feel, it's too bad. It's a drag. I feel bad for you, Sam. Right? But life goes on for me, doesn't it? But I just got word that my house burned down. Now, this is serious. Right. This is significant. You see what I'm saying? It's just words. Just different words. Marilyn's house, my house. I haven't seen the house, have I? I wasn't there at the fire. I don't know anything. I just think. My mental representation of my house has now changed, and I experience immediately upset, loss. It's a total mental experience that I'm fabricating for myself. This mind is very interesting. So these are the kind of things you may be meditating on. You may be, there are people here who are working with acknowledging feelings. Acknowledging parts of themselves, feelings, memories, mind states, that in the past they didn't want to touch, didn't want to acknowledge. Ego states, these unworthiness or unlovability, all of a sudden willing to embrace them, let them in, be present to them, be mindful, aware. And seeing again how they're all suffused with self-identity. I am this, I am that. I am good, I am bad. I am lovable, I am unlovable. I have a good life, I have a bad life. These are all mental events, every one of them. Please meditate deeply on these things so you can liberate yourself and be free.